You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I couldn't find the audio, but I have now, so we can shut this off. So without further ado, right, we have some new music here to accompany the Lynch and Kenny Hour here on All Marine Radio. Metallica with the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra. Like, what? So when you hear Sandman, think of Lynch and Kenny. They join me now. Joining me from Southern California, Jeff Kenny. Jeff, how are you doing?
Good, Matt. How are you?
I'm all right. This is actually the second time we're trying this because I didn't start the fucking recording the first time. So, well done, Jeff. And joining me for a second time also is Tim Lynch. Tim, how are you doing?
Happy to be here again, my friend.
For take two. All right, Jeff, you already started this thing once. Let's see if you can do it a second time.
And I'll be better because I got wrapped around the axle there and the number shits. But yeah, the Covenant's planning guidance he came out with covered the normal subjects that a Covenant would, you know.
Right.
But the thing that struck me when he talked about operational design, he talked about getting back to, now that it seems like our CENTCOM adventures are coming to around the wane, that he's talking about return to naval roots, particularly it seemed like in regards to the Indo-PACOM theater. And there was a time when we had a lot of amphib ships, and that gave us flexibility in regards to deploying MUs, and we established a pretty good routine, which we didn't appreciate at the time. Number of acts of resources amphibious-wise from the Navy has degraded. The Marine Corps has a lot of jobs, job residuals left over from both what happened in Iraq and what happened in Afghanistan and just the CENTCOM area in general. So he wants to kind of bring us back to where the Marine Corps is defined by the fact that they're amphibious force in readiness, particularly in the PACOM area. But one thing he said a little bit different.
I played General Berger's entire confirmation hearing yesterday on the program. Right. I mean, I like to do that. I like to hear those guys in long format, right? In their own words, in long format. And so one of the things that was interesting, and he was sitting next to Admiral Moran, whose nomination has since been withdrawn. But one of the things the senators were hammering Admiral Moran on was the Navy cannot build a ship on time, and it can't build it anywhere near to the budget that is brought before Congress when the project is approved. And senators were into Moran like white on rice in terms of what happens to other programs when you can't bring anything in at cost. I mean, you know, and so if you want to, and so to me, what's interesting about the amphib, you know, issue is, it is the redheaded stepchild of the Navy. And so when when submarines go over, when aircraft go over budget, when other ships go over budget, you know, what gets cut?
And yeah.
And it's the redheaded stepchild. And so it's interesting, you know, how you see this. And so Moran was doing cartwheels, you know, saying that we are going to fix this problem because nothing they do comes in on time and nothing they, I mean, and when I say on time, I mean years beyond when it's supposed to hit the fleet. You know, you've slept other ships, you've done all the things that the Navy does with ships to have a schedule, and then they don't come near the schedule. It misses it by 3 or 4 years. And so,
And General Berger,
pretty interesting.
Guidance kind of dovetails with that, Mac, and then he says, you know, we may have to help the Navy by maybe not going out in the configurations we're used to, like the size of the size of our ARG, like the size of the MagCap.
Well, let me ask you this, Jeff, and because I've had a couple conversations about that with people, and what they've said is that there's different ways to skin this cat other than the way we've historical. And so the question is, how do you be, you know, maybe we have enough ships to do, you know, smaller Muse, because you only need X amount aboard the ship, and then you can fly the rest of it in someplace in proximity, and then you Osprey those, you know, into the battle area, you know. So he said, look, we may need more than 38, but we don't need 38 amphibs. Maybe that number comes down.
Talking about black bottom ships.
Yeah. So talk. So that to me, because that was one of the biggest headlines, because that has been the 38 ship amphibious. You know, and 38 amphibious platforms have been a Marine Corps, you know, party platform plank forever, for a long time anyway. And we all know the Navy's not going anywhere near it, and there's no, you know. So anyway, so talk about black bottom ships and that kind of stuff.
Well, the black bottom ships are like civilian, kind of like the MPS ships. Right. They're civilian ships that can be used in certain areas. Like they can have, you know, portions of their crew be active duty U.S. Navy, and they're basically the thing we're used to is the MPS ships that were there that could basically outfit a Marine brigade or, you know, regiment reinforced, and we use them in Desert Storm, and we use them in other places like Somalia and so forth. But the other thing you talked about was Army. The Army has a lot of lighterage ships. When I say lighterage, we think of lighterage as like causeways that you used to have on the ships, and but they're really, what we're talking about is connectors, like big versions of the LCU and the LCAC. The Army has to move; they are ocean going. I mean, they can cross the Atlantic no problem. Now, my personal experience is we use that lighterage stuff as target ships to train to do VBSS for the MEW when I was in charge of EOTG and TUMEF. And they're very capable. And I think he's talking about using our imagination to come up with, just like you said, Mac, you know, you got a big deck, and you got maybe an LST or not an LST, I'm sorry, an LPH or an LPD and an LSD. And for those folks out there who don't know what I'm talking about, those are ships, pointy ships that have a flight deck, but they also can, and their main purpose is to put off landing craft and like amphibious assault tractors. But you can also augment yourself by these other things that aren't what we would traditionally think of as U.S. Navy amphib combatants. And he also talked about the idea that the GCE can do more. We have an accident of technology that I got a little bit of experience with in the MEW. The Osprey, the legs on it are amazing. The speed and the legs on the thing, meaning the range of it. And if you have the C-130s to refuel it, it virtually, you know, is unlimited range and can actually put itself places that we never could think of before. You put that in with some of our radio reconnaissance assets and some of the new seagoing drones we have, you know, you have the capability of doing of targeting bad guy formations, you know, in hostile littorals, and then hitting them with precision guided munitions from pointy ships. pointy ships being, you know, the Navy's destroyers and fast frigates and cruisers and so forth. So I think you can also shoot pretty good fires from HIMARS, you know, our rockets, from the deck of these, you know, from platforms on the deck of these amphibs. So it's basically talking about, and he doesn't get specific about that, but I know a little bit about the specifics of it.
Well, we have, we had an example, two weeks ago, right, when they used a new technology off the deck of an amphib to down one, maybe two
drones. Exactly. That's one thing. And the other thing, General Mellor was really pushing when he was MAR-4COM, and then as Commandant, they did amphibious landings where you had to clear the you had mines on the in the surf and on the beach, and so it was basically like an old fashioned only thing using new technology line charge type stuff to basically render a beach a beach landing site safe.
So the bottom line is what is your sense of coming off that party platform plank? Of 38 amphibs, where is the Marine Corps going to go? Is it going to get more creative in the use of, ships that we can rent, ships that we can buy and convert, all sending the price of this stuff, to the hopefully near or close to the floor.
Yeah, one of the things that General Berger brings up though is the risk. What's the civilian leadership willing to take as far as risk? Because some of the lethality of we have it and our adversaries have it too. The ability to reach out and touch things like as valuable as carriers from a long distance. And so the idea of doing some of this imaginative stuff, these things are not made to operate in this way, and so consequently, you have to really look at the risk. I have to tell you, strike fighter,
Right, the F-35.
F-35. It's so expensive and so capable that they don't want to risk it. I mean, I'm talking at the actual service command levels.
Well, I'll tell you what. The other thing that was interesting to listen to them talk about was, the CH-53 Kilo comes in at $100 million.
It's incredible.
An aircraft. Yeah. And so to me, one of the things that when you look at big procurement, and I'll tell you what, and for everybody listening to this, I would encourage you, listen to his confirmation testimony. And what I did was I cropped Moran and much of the bloviating out of it, and I cut it down to about an hour, and most of the hour is Berger, and I left Moran in a couple times talking about issues like this. But, as Jeff was saying, when you consider long-range precision fires, the day is probably done when you're going to move a brigade in proximity to something. If there's escalating tensions in the region, you're gonna get it close, and then it's gonna have to move by air, protected into the close area of what I would call close combat, or you got to be there already. You got to be there before that. Which look at what the Marine Corps is doing in Australia. And things like that. So it was very interesting to hear them talk about, look, the old way we used to get places in our minds when we think of an amphibious operation, that has probably changed forever. And Berger, I think, in my opinion, coming off that, it's a simple realization that you're not going to get there with those platforms and close with it. Unless you do it, a month before, thing gets really hot. And so, there's different platforms that we can use that are much more cost effective, and we can have more of them if we do it differently. So that was my takeaway after reading a little bit.
That's a good idea. I will watch that. And, do you have your crop thing?
Yeah, it's on the website.
Okay, I'll look at that.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, too. It's a possibility that we could be in places that, little hunks of dirt, either in the Indo-PACOM area, And we don't have one thing that we probably need to get back into the into the business of is anti-ship artillery, anti-ship missiles from the ground. Like, you know, we used to have whole battalions, you know, of guys doing that during the Second World War. I mean, that's what George Shultz was in, you know, Reagan's Secretary of Defense. He was a defense battalion guy.
Coastal,
and that's what they did. You know,
coastal,
the idea was
coastal defense guy?
Yes. They were in Guadalcanal. They were in New Georgia. Once they, you know, not too far behind the grunts. They're in there. And the idea was to prevent Japanese seaborne counterattack.
Let me ask. My assumption is between the Navy and our aviation platforms, they would hunt the shit out of those things and destroy them.
Yeah, what I'm getting, because that came up, and we had a discussion about this with the ATB officers and staff and COs, and the air side of our air guys are saying we pretty much suck at the ship hunting thing. That really is not, that's an art form in itself, I guess, and the Marine Corps is kind of not as good as we used to be at.
Wow. Well, you know the other thing, and
takes you back, you know, into it. But.
Hey, Timmy, you can talk. You don't have to be quiet the whole time. The other thing is, I just wanted to tell you. The other thing is you know, like we talked about this relative to the targeting solution with hypersonic weapons. Like, yeah, it sounds great, but you have to acquire the target somehow. And if you want to shoot like Mount Rushmore, that's fine, but if you want to shoot a dynamic target, you have to be able to acquire it, and that ain't easy. Once everybody turns off each other's satellites, now what? You know, is what we can see limited to the AWACS drone and the six AWACS drones that go out, and that's all data linked to everybody else? That's the extent of our radar coverage, because everything else has been, you know, knocked out of the sky. So it's. I think that the discussions get really interesting when you say, okay, you're not going to have all this stuff. And, you know, our experience in Iraq and Afghanistan was a completely permissive environment. We did anything we want. We had everything we wanted, and we did it when we wanted to do it. And so much different when trying to conceive it.
Hey, you know what about the combat planning guidance? So is I look upon it as almost an attempt to save the Marine Corps from future threats by tying it to the Navy and making it relevant again. Because I've mentioned this a couple times in the past, is eventually we're going to have a Democratic administration and they're going to be frantically looking for money. I'm telling you, if we don't have a story that is different than the last time that we had to tell a story in order to save the Marine Corps, I think that was one of the things that would seriously be on the chopping block. I'm dead serious. And this to me makes them relevant, but if you're talking about expeditionary advanced base operations, you've got to integrate with contractors, because you can't afford to have a bunch of little expeditionary bases that are manned 24/7, 365 by active duty people.
And that's part of it too. He kind of talked. I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah,
I mean, he did it.
Yeah,
he talks about.
And there's a smart way. And there's a smart way to do it. You know, the Marine Corps can sit there and buy name people into a. There's a smart way to do it, and a stupid way to do it, and a stupid way to do contracting is low bid, technically acceptable, which is what we do. Whereas there's no reason why a new commander couldn't handpick the damn team of the civilians that he's dealing with. Out of guys that he knows. You know what I'm saying, Jeff?
You're right about that. That's how they got me, that lowball thing.
But you can sit there and body shop in by name guys to fill out your force, and so you're working with a civilian military force that's really used to working with each other if you're smart about it. But you've got to incorporate contractors, because you can't afford to have active duty Marines that out like that.
Yeah. The other thing it was amazing what these new commander, along with some EOTG folks, came up with the idea of having a blood warmer, a defibrillator, and some other emergency stuff to keep your ass alive if you had way out beyond what we would call the golden hour. You had the ability to extend that golden hour a little bit, and that was another you know, way of extending the Navy's reach, you know.
Right, right.
That was bottom-up stuff.
Yeah, that's you know, in my conversations with different, you know, commanders on active duty, you know, asking them about the golden hour, they say, yeah, you know, in our discussions in a peer war, there won't be a golden hour. And what we'll need is we'll need portable defibrillators. We'll need that technology to get nanoized, and we'll also need improvements in blood plasma and the way we can do that. And so we can keep, you know, maybe it's golden 3 hours. And right. The advancements made in the first aid kit, you know, if you got to the Marine Corps. When it was the green plastic container that you put your smokes in to keep them dry, it's your IFAC, your first aid kit, is the size of your gas mask carrier back in the day. It is that big, and it's that good too.
Quick clot. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you now have things in there that no shit work. You have tourniquets that work. You have quick clot that works. There's all kinds of stuff in there that work. And so, really, I mean, we need to apply DOD money, you know, to those things, anticipating that, you know, hey, look, you got to be able to keep them alive for 3 hours.
Do you remember that old
stupid medical kit? I mean, the only thing that was in there was Band-Aids and iodine, and it was ridiculous. Oh, you're in the field dressing.
Yeah, and a black safety pin.
That's right. With the safety pin, that's right. That's right. But everybody took those.
You could also get in a machine gun bandolier.
Exactly. I still have one. I just saw one the other day in a bunch of my shit. I'm like, yep. those things came in handy. You don't throw them away, man. You don't throw them away. No. That. So I agree. The whole, you know, in his guidance, that probably got the most publicity was the, you know, well, there was a couple other things, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the second meth, what he talked about with the second meth. Very interesting.
Well, and he also said that the Marine Corps 2025, right?
Right.
So much discussed and all, don't refer to it anymore. We're going in a different direction. I think all that stuff's very interesting. I think Berger's an interesting guy because, you know, if you talk to people that know him and served under him, he's not an iconoclastic guy, you know?
No.
And so
I worked for him real close when I was ATG and he was McCaxey every week. And he was out there every class watching advisors train, watching the role players, always a very solid guy.
Right.
Very solid, very he didn't say a lot, but when he did, it was dead on.
Well, and
he watched everything. So I think when he did that, Mac, like what you're saying there, and he already talked to Moran and other Navy folks, and they've got it, you know, they knew what each other was going to say. I mean, it's probably obvious that
right.
they did, but I mean, he didn't just say it off the cuff, you know, we got to be the Navy's whore. It wasn't, he would go that way. So he's talking about, you know, us and them got to...
I would say this. It's also partly the Marine Corps' come to Jesus moment because, you know, the Navy, right, has told us, I mean, in every possible way, if you don't know, it's not a priority for us. And we don't, and now, and then I think, you know, the last nail in the coffin of all of it was, the increased lethality and the pivot to the Pacific, and you combine great power conflict along with increased lethality, and you have so many people saying, you're not going to be able to get this thing there. You've either already got to be there, or you're going to get to the region, and then you're going to somehow or other get to where you need to go, but it's got to be fast, because if it's slow, it's going to get whacked. And so I think it was the Marine Corps. I don't. Some people would say in denial for years about what the Navy was doing. But as to me, I think White rightly points out, you know, getting in bed with the Navy and on a common vision of what needs to happen in the future.
And the Navy is as anxious for good press as we are. And you get a
even,
lot of...
Hey, even more exactly, so, man. Did you exactly see that there's another Fat Leonard version in coming out of Korea now?
Oh, man, you don't even... I didn't even want to talk about that. It's unbelievable. Yeah. I think so far it's only a U.S. with the civilian command ships.
So far.
So far. U.S. Yeah, yeah. USNS or whatever.
But normally...
That was an LHG that took that fucking that drone down, you know, in Iran. So it's like stuff from there, you know, that was stuff from that amphib. So, like I say, as long as good press is happening. Now, we move off the idea we're always in these places. It's bound to have, you're bound to have issues in West Africa where you have a repeat with a different different threat than you had in the 90s with Liberia and Sierra Leone and so forth, where you got guys who are Boko Haram types threatening governments that are within range, and with the Osprey, range is way extended, of an amphib task force that can evacuate beleaguered Americans and third country nationals. That's always great press. That always makes the Navy look good. And for them to get away, for them to drop, you know, below into real dangerous levels, that's one thing they'll, you know, they'll encourage them not to. Talk to General Furness about some of the machinations he went through in OLA about financing new amphibs and stuff. He's got allies in the Navy, but it is difficult.
Right, right. I'll tell you another interesting part of Berger's confirmation hearing that I left in there was the discussion of somebody quoting some think tank guy saying, by 2030, China will have more naval platforms than we will have, and they will be on a peer in terms of skill level.
Yeah.
And they asked them to, you know, give us your thoughts on that. I mean, can we get to 355 ships? And that's when the very interesting part of, well, you're not going to get there if you can't build them on time and you can't build them at cost.
Right.
You know? And so that was very interesting. That was very interesting.
The shit you got to do to an amphib to be able to accommodate those F-35s is unbelievable.
Right.
Basically, you got to turn it into another ship.
$34,000 an hour to in cost to fly an F-35 for an hour.
Hey, what do you think though would happen to a Chinese lieutenant that collided his ship with an oil tanker?
He'd be with the Uyghurs in the concentration camp.
He wouldn't even. He wouldn't make it back to port.
Yeah, they don't play that game.
Yeah.
He'd be learning how to speak Uyghur.
I got to tell you this: when I read this thing from the commandant, when he said that 2MEF is going to undergo substantial changes, I was thinking, is the 2nd Marine Division ever been in a better position to undergo substantial changes than it is right now? Seeing how much attention Dave's given. To make sure everybody understands what it is he expects.
Can you just lay out the basics relative to General Berger's guidance to 2MEF?
Yeah, so what basically he said to 2MEF was that they're going to undergo substantial changes to better align them with the 2nd and the 6th fleets. Now what that means, I don't have any idea. But it does mean that there's going to be substantial changes in how it's organized. And if I'm not mistaken, what he's saying is they're not going to be doing UDPs like out of the East Coast anymore. That's what it seems to say to me. But then again, 3MEF is the focus of effort. So what the hell? He might still be pulling people out of there. But it means that 2nd Marine Division is going to have to change. And I don't know what that changes are going to be. But Dave already having everybody's attention with a couple of major things that he's done, I've never seen a division better positioned to change, because normally it'd be like they have to start changing and the division commander would be going around and Marines be like, well, who the hell's this guy again? Oh, the division commander. Yeah, sure. I mean, most Marines don't know who the hell the division commander is.
I think they do at Camp Lejeune.
That's what I'm saying.
So 6th Fleet, they're in the Med, right?
Yeah.
Right.
2nd Fleet is in the North Atlantic now?
They right. Should, yeah. Right.
Norway.
Right. Yeah, Norway and all that.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a pretty interesting discussion. Do you remember the senator that held up Berger's appointment? He's from Alaska, right?
Yeah. I don't remember why he did.
Well, he did it because he said, hey, look, you know, he's trying to get more DOD dollars into Alaska. And he says, look, there's nobody closer to the Arctic Circle than Alaska. There's nobody further west in the Pacific than Alaska. And again, you have to think about it. We're further west than Midway. We're further west than Hawaii. So we're further west than all kinds of places. And the Marine Corps, you know, why doesn't the Marine Corps come up and do cold weather training in Alaska? We'd love to see that. And so General Berger had gone up to Alaska. So I mean, him holding the nomination up was, I think, just to drive home the point. I was serious about, you know, you coming to Alaska, and we have great things to offer and whatnot. So that was kind of an interesting little point relative to not only Arctic capabilities and the ability to do big operations in cold weather. And so it's kind of, the tone of it was, you know, we have this, you know, we have the Arctic looming out there, right? And that's a certain skill set. We have operations in the Western Pacific that everybody's looking at. But it's not like you can walk away from, you know, the small wars that we've been fighting.
Well, you know, right? We were discussing this today. The planning guidance and the people are going, some of these, you know, Marines who now are coming up on 20 years, but they came in like 2002, 2001, and like, you know, they really think it's great that we're going to be paying attention to China and, you know, and that. And I said, I have to tell you, back in the 90s, everybody was talking, we got to pay more attention to, you know, PACOM, the Pacific, and everything. Everybody from James Webb to everybody was saying, hey, we got to do, and then bang. You know, September 11th happens, and, you know.
Well, you know what I remember when at IOC, I remember, you know, these people writing about our next adversaries, and this would have been in the early 90s, are going to be stateless, right, actors. And it was like, who are you talking about?
Yeah.
Right? Because, you know, the thing in Beirut had happened. But most of us really didn't understand how that whole thing was wire diagram back to Iran, right? And we didn't, Hezbollah, you know, I mean, we didn't understand it, and we've all got a much different education. So what's interesting in the hearing is, you know, listening to Berger articulate, hey, we have to be generalists. We can't specifically dedicate ourselves to any of these propositions because we're all involved in all of them. And so we've got to be good at all of them. We get that. But he was talking about the Arctic. He said those are very specific skill sets. And so those, you know, that's why you have to go up there and exercise, because you got to keep, you know, those lessons in people's heads, and you got to do it on a regular basis. And that's really as good as it gets. And you got to do that in the desert, and then you got to go to, you know, the hot, humid climates of the Western Pacific, where you're going to learn very different lessons about maintenance, you know, about movement, about water,
right?
All those things that are unique to every part of the world. So interesting.
Hey, that is so true. I mean that from the big movements, they need it. Getting your folks out there, whether it's by ship to shore or whether it's, you know, flying, different climates pose different challenges at every level,
right?
You know, and the only way you can really, you know, get yourself sensitized to it is to do it.
Right. Got to get out there.
Hey, man, but you don't have to do it in damn Alaska. It's a lot nicer to go do it in Norway. It's easier to go right across the Atlantic. Hell is that? And people are friendlier.
Well, we need to ship. Maybe we could get some, like, Honduran people to go up to Alaska. And then we could go visit them.
I've only been stopped at the airport in Anchorage when we refuel going to and from places. But
yeah,
have you guys, either one of you, been up to Alaska? I've heard it's absolutely breathtaking.
No, not me.
No, I have.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, that's the only time I'm going that way and stopping off at the Big Bear statue there in the airport, you know, and the big stuff, the Kodiak Bear, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, on the way to Okinawa. That's the only time I've been there either. Yeah.
All right, so let me ask you this. So Alaska is 663,000 square miles. Okay, so just so you could fit Texas in there, how many times?
Well, five.
Many.
Almost three.
Wow.
Yeah, probably two and a half. So that's how big Alaska is. I mean, I was like, when I heard that, what? That's a big state. So anyway, that's what that was about. Any final? So it's interesting. General Berger's reputation is as a smart, steady, solid guy, right? So it'll be interesting to see how different the tack he takes with the Marine Corps will be. But coming out of the chute, it raised a lot of people's eyes, the things that he did, and they said, wow, I've heard people say, I didn't really expect it, but I think he's spot on. So that, yeah. I think that's interesting.
He's very, very smart guy, very, could make decisions quick, but they're good. He's thinking about it already,
Right. And when we were talking last week about have you ever seen guidance like David put out, Joe Furness had put out or whatnot, this guidance, I've never seen anything like this from a commandant before. Of course, I haven't been around for almost 20 years, but this is a no-bullshit document. You read this, and there's no doubt in your mind what the commandant expects out of you, and it's pretty damn clear.
Ever since General Gray was the last one I thought was good, ever since then it's been a boring version of the Jody, don't let your dangle in the grass.
Stupid SOPs I'm always talking about.
Yeah, more.
They seem very standard. Yeah.
Yeah, more boilerplate than substance.
Right, and there's nothing boilerplate about this. Guy's definitely taking charge. I'm impressed. I really am.
Well, we'll see. The proof, the proof is in the doing. And anybody can write a document. So we'll see. I mean, and that's the challenge. Is General Neller's job was to improve really the Marine Corps' readiness across the board, aviation, and hit the reset button on a lot of things, and so while we're not out of that phase of retooling the Marine Corps is now looking as a lot of people said, the Marine Corps is looking for a mission. If it isn't amphibious landing, right? It better be expeditionary, forward-deployed expeditionary warfare, and first to fight. What does that mean in a peer-to-peer fight where you're not going to get on a ship and go rolling in there? And I think that's the problem that he's got to solve, is what does expeditionary mean today, in today's world? And so we'll see. It'll certainly be interesting to watch Jerome Berger do it. And I would tell you what, I think a lot of people have given him high marks, Look, as Jeff said, he's a solid guy. He's not an iconoclast. So this is smart guy stuff, and they're solid moves. They're in sync with the Navy, which is even better probably for the Marine Corps. So interesting. Let's see. All right, Timmy, topic number two.
Okay, so if you go on the website of a military art by Dick Kramer, there's a bunch of artists. Dick Kramer's been doing these lithographs for 30, 40 years now.
Okay, hold on.
Called the Grunt.
Hold on. Or you can just click on this post, and you will see the piece of art that Timmy's talking about.
Right. Okay. And you'll see the Grunt. And it's a Marine Corps corporal, circa 1995, M16A2. One of the things that you'll notice about it is there's no sling on his rifle. And if you look at the other parts in this, the other prints in this series, there's one called the Fire Team, which is why I'm bitter, by the way, is the Fire Team one. You'll notice that none of the Marines have any slings on their weapons. And so I wanted to bring this up for a couple reasons. First off, is so you'll tell Alex Hollins that I'm an old gangster. I'm an OG gear asshole. Okay, because that Grunt in that print is actually Dick Kramer's son, and this is part of my little bittersweet memories, because it always seems like I got there's always something that kind of rubs you the wrong way about like my company command. This is the thing. So the XO was already pissed at me because I had successfully avoided getting one of my lieutenants into the adjutant seat, and he called me in and says, hey, one of your Marines' dad is coming over to take some pictures because he's going to make some drawings, And so you got to bring him in from the field and get him ready and get him out here. I want you to be here to talk to the guy and don't have your stupid goddamn slings on those weapons. Because everybody in my company had bought a Bowie Packer horizontal side loop tactical sling. This is 95, mind you. I got a hell of a deal.
Okay, hold on. Explain to everybody what kind of sling that is.
Okay, so what this was it was a piece of wire that went underneath the front sight post, right, and looped over there, and it had a cord, had a big long loop in the back end. So there's two stoppers that you put in the rear that you got into the rear a sling swivel, and then the loop would go over the rear end there, and the weapon would hang out ready, and you could tighten it really easy and make it right up your back. And it had a quick release buckle, so you like if you had both your hands.
It's like a 1-point sling.
Right, exactly. It was the forerunner of all this stuff. And I had kind of said, look, we ought to have this stuff in the field. And my battalion commander had said you can do it, but you can't have them in the armory like that. And so when this Kramer guy showed up, my slings was all the SL3 gear was on the way to 29 Palms. You know, I didn't have them anyway. So out we go out and I meet this guy and he says and it's going to be one with like the company commander, but that's not going to be you. Make it the edge because the edge was getting his second tour as the edge, and he was really bitter about it. But this kind of made him feel better. But I didn't realize who Dick Kramer was until like some people started showing up with like drawings and prints and asking them to sign them and stuff like that. I'm like, son of a bitch, man. But my point about bringing that all up was, you know, I hear you about standardized gear, but you know, for instance, you were talking about when you were a lieutenant, when you're out at 29 out in Camp Pendleton, you couldn't wear desert boots or excuse me, jungle boots or have the jungle covers. Which and at the same time, I was in the First Marines at Horno, and we were issued that stuff when we joined the MEU. So we definitely went with jungle boots, and we definitely had the jungle covers. That was part of our issue as joining the MEU. And I always was looking for experimental gear. I was bitter when I couldn't wear my Fort Lewis, you know, Go Devil boots there at IOC, because goddamn those speed lace boots just sucked, you know. Yeah. But that was something I always believed in, was experimenting. And I remember the first time I ever saw a Camelback was with old Neil Shuley. He was a corporal back then at Force Recon. They had these Camelbacks, and then the ace on the Mew, they immediately adopted the Camelbacks. They're like, oh, this is a great idea. And this was years before the military adopted them.
What did the ace on the Mew need Camelbacks for?
Oh, for the guys working on the flight deck.
Yeah, working on the flight deck from those airplanes.
Oh, yeah, they're out there 12 hours a day getting blasted in the fucking sun, right? So they were the first guys, and the new commander was said, yeah, we'll go ahead and authorize this. But there was years of people fighting about the goddamn Camelbacks before everybody just went ahead and adopted them when we started fighting after 9-1-1.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I'll tell you what, though. I don't know if they would have been allowed to have worn them, because nothing goes on the flight deck except what the air boss fucking approves. And the only thing that those guys approved were those fucking vests that they used to wear, right? That you know, your vest over your fucking turtleneck.
Yeah, because if something happens in an aircraft, they look at everything.
Right. They don't.
Oh, it happened because the guy was wearing
But they got the hydration patch in their vest now.
Oh no, I don't doubt it. I'm just trying to remember back then.
I remember. I'm almost positive that's the same. I might have that wrong. I could well. But my point being that there were people that were out using this gear in the field before and putting up these needs statements and kind of trying to drive some change. Because a lot of that stuff that we deal with now, I mean, shit, there was a time where, I mean, if you were in the second MAR Div, Jeff, could you have a Leatherman on your war belt?
Everybody had Leathermans, but I remember it being displayed.
I'm talking about with General, because with General Van Riper, if I'm understanding his 8th Marines thing, you were not authorized to have that. If it was not issued to you, that was shit you did not need. And I've always thought that was not the...
I started seeing that in 96, and it was Recon. It was our force guys. Remember Wilson from IOC, the guy who had been a drill instructor? He was a platoon commander, and his guys had Camelbacks. I'm like, what the fuck is that? And That's a good idea. That was 95, though.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And I, that was just the one thing I wanted to point out. A, because I'm hoping that Alex Hollins listens and hooks up, you know, he needs another gear evaluator. But B, it's just an interesting discussion because there's a lot of times that you find gear that's really, really good in the field. And, you know, what do you think? Do you authorize people to bring it out? Or do you say, nope, if it's not an issue to you, you don't bring it? Because that to me is a discussion worth having.
You know what? Years ago, I would have been, you authorized people to bring it. But now, I don't believe that. If it's not issued to me, because not every, at the end of the day, not all your Marines can buy that stuff. You know, some are married and their wives, you know, their family situation, they don't have a lot of extra money and they can't buy that stuff. And so the reason you've got to wear what they wear is, as a leader, you can't have a different gear set.
That's what told us in IOC. And then I got down to Lejeune, and I agree with it. And I got down to Lejeune, the cars these guys are driving are unbelievable.
I'm with you. But you know, when you go forward, right, all of a sudden you're replacing utilities, you're replacing boots, and right, and it's all your issue shit.
If you're an officer, you should always set the example, even if it sucks. You got to set the example. You got to always get just like you always got to shave. You always got, you know what I mean. You just got to.
That was the one reason I always responded to is you've got to set the example. If the guys out there suffering in those damn speed laces, you got to suffer in the speed laces.
And it sucks, man, I hate it because you know the frustrating part was we were wearing gear that wasn't close to being the best gear that we could have worn, and it was miserable to wear it. And yet, you know, I remember walking by my Danners in the cold of winter, right, to go to work just in Quantico, where, you know, it was so miserable. And you'd say, see you later, guys. Maybe someday I can take you with me, but, you know, not today. Right? You had guys who would keep them in their car when the sun would go down. They'd put those son of a bitches on. You know, because nobody's going to see it in the dark, and they weren't going to freeze their, you know, they weren't going to freeze their ass off again tonight. And, you know, so it's frustrating, but, you know, I think we all, you know, you all see the merit in, hey, you got to wear what they're wearing and not any different. But again, to me, if you're going to stress that level of uniformity, one of the things you have to do is you got to have an outlet to test new gear, you know? And
that's exactly right.
And if 2-8, right, and it might be the sergeant's council, you know, reviews it, makes a recommendation to the battalion commander, 2-8's battalion commander then recommends to the regimental commander, hey, sir, we would like to authorize this and do a test on it. And, you know, then you get with your procurement guys. And so that it is kind of a vibrant place that we're always trying to look and make recommendation to the ground board on equipment and things like that. And so Marines know you're thinking about it. It's not this draconian, no, bush covers, never. It's like, yeah, boys, we're fighting for it, but because we know it's good gear, but we got all these Vietnam fuckers that keep saying no. So I think that's an important part of it not being just another stupid rule. You know what I mean? We're not doing stupid. We're trying to do good stuff. And so I think that's important.
And the other thing I wanted for everybody who's a Dick Kramer aficionado, because I mean he does prints from all over the world. That one, the Grunt print, that is his son. It was a great squad leader, by the way. Good kid. Went on to law school. But, it was nice meeting them.
Us getting jammed into those Hummers in Iraq, you know, the up-armored Hummers, you know, up to the 1114s, that really caused, everybody couldn't wear their shit the same way, even close, kind of where you're sitting in that thing. And I remember that's where I got, I had an M4, and I had I ended up for a sling, all I had was that thing that clipped to the front of my right shoulder. And that's where my rifle was. When I got blown up, that's where it was. And I had an A4 that was my rifle I took from the Mew, but I got the M4 from a guy who left, who was like there before me. He just gave it to me. And I thought, wow, this is, you know, and after I got blown up, that weapon got wrecked One of my jobs as the AT, as the advisor trainer guy, Coates put this on me, Colonel Coates, find all these weapons. And I'm thinking, holy shit, all the weapons got all mixed up from both MEPs, both 1 and 2 MEP and 3 MEP a little bit, to where that's where I found out about the Crane report. Because of that, you know, because of, a lot of it had to do with trying to establish uniformity and how you gonna, you know, how you gonna keep track of these weapons and stuff like that. It was so frenetic that, you know, the I remember thinking, you know, you go back to basics and you don't go wrong. You know, I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. The Crane report, something you can track down weapons from.
No, when you lose something, when you destroy something, within I don't know how many hours, and I know because as lieutenant, my platoon was, or my unit one was 1-5, and I told elements of the story, but we were the first battalion to take the M249, the squad automatic weapon.
Oh, okay.
Right, we took all of our armory shit with us, our M16A2s, our 9, I think we had 9 mils, and our saws. We took that gear set to Okinawa, and whoever we were replacing, 2-5, I think, they brought their shit back. And so that's how we rotated weapons out there. So anyway, I had this thing where there had to be one NCO that went hole to hole to hole if we were going to be at 25%, 50%, and we had to enforce that, right? So I get tagged on Team Spirit heading up, Highway 7 on the eastern coast of the Korean Peninsula. I get tagged as a casualty on the first day. I get flown out to some fucking hospital ship, and they say, you got to stay here for a day. And I said, okay. And then I said, what do I do now? They're like, oh, well, you go downstairs and find a place to sleep and all that. And I said, okay. So then I went back, back to the fantail, and the guys that were like the AGDAG guys there, the guys who scheduled people to leave, and I walked up to them and said, hey, I'm supposed to go back to my unit now. And they're like, oh, okay, who are you with? 1-5. And they said, okay, all right, we'll get you on the next helo. So I got on the next helo. I didn't get back to 1-5 till the next day. I hitched a ride back to Charlie Company, and I come walking up, and my staff sergeant says, well, Lieutenant, I'm really glad to see you. And which he had never said before, right? And so I said, why? What happened? He said, well, you know how you have somebody stay up with everybody? And I said, yeah. He said, well, I didn't do that last night. And I said, and? He said, the locals snuck into our perimeter and took one of our packs, and it had a spare barrel on it, and a saw spare barrel. And they had to do a Crane report because it's got to be reported within 24 hours. And ultimately, we went to like the village elder. My first experience with village elders and mayors and shit was in Korea, and took like 6 cases of MREs and said, hey, could you get that barrel back? And within like 10 minutes, the pack with its cut straps and the barrel, were back in somebody's hands. And that was all they returned. Everything that was inside the pack was someplace else, but nobody gave a shit about that, right? We had the barrel back.
Yeah.
And then
what happened with us was we had like during 2000, between 2006 and 2007, we had like 50 KIA just in the advisor teams.
Wow.
And then a bunch of wounded, and then we had a bunch of units that were given that were like losing weapons because like the Humvee got burned up and stuff.
Right.
So trying to find them from one MEF, we finally found them using that Crane report. We found them, either they were destroyed, or the last 7 that we found were in 3rd LAR's armory, and they had been used by 2 MEF guys. How they got them, I don't know. All I know is, by using the Crane report, we were able to track them down. And we had been missing, like, 400 weapons at one point.
What?
You know, and it was like, do you remember the big scandal with somebody in 1 MEF stealing, churched up AK-47s with like golden magazines.
Yes, yes, oh yeah, fuck yeah, everybody heard about that.
People thought it was part of that. It wasn't. It was just wounded guys and people trading weapons who they don't remember where they got theirs from. I remember the guy gave it to me. I thought, well, I'll never lose this thing, and I didn't lose it. It just got burned up, you know. But
Yeah. No, you know, let me tell you, people, I mean, you know, we should probably do a show about that, you know, and that is, you know, when people get killed, right, what happens to all their equipment, you know, what do you do with their personal effects, and, you know, and our supply guys account for all this stuff, you know, go inventory everybody's stuff, you know, because, you know, all of a sudden the family comes back to you and says, hey, what about this? We gave him this, and now it's missing. And I mean, some of that's just horrible. And then there's the gear you got to account for, and everything that's serialized that you have to account for. And I mean, it's the things. I mean, to include, I'll tell you this. One of the things I dealt with once was to include body parts.
Yeah.
If somebody's dead, their family, right? And you find their leg. Their family has to be notified that you found additional remains, and their family decides what happens to those remains, if they're brought back and interred with the rest of the body, or if you say destroy it. If they're still alive, right, it's like your appendix. We just destroy it. Right. And
I had a guy working for me as the XO of EOTG, and he was an I&I guy, and they had this kid who got blown, who got killed, and they kept finding other parts of the guy from that, and the family was devastated. It was their only son, you know, and they kept having to go through this torturous thing with, you know, another part of the kid was found, you know, over a 6-month period. The guy's name was Wynn Tierney. I don't know if you ever knew him.
No.
You know, but not the guy who died, the guy who was the XO from
him. Okay.
Yeah, it's a really compelling story about exactly what you're talking about.
It's gut wrenching. It's gut wrenching because they got to do another notification. And you put the family through all that shit again, it's
awesome. I have to tell you, though, that would be a good thing, because, like, when I was in the hospital, some of my gear came back, and Lori and my mom opened it, and they almost died of the stench. You know what I mean? It was like, it was my shit from me being hit and everything, so it was blood soaked and everything, and then it was crusted, and they don't give a shit. It's my stuff. It's coming back.
Right.
You know?
Well, yeah, and there's two schools of thoughts on that, right? There's another school of thought of, hey, we need to go through his stuff and make sure there's nothing in there that's, you know, that in any way, shape, or form diminishes him, whether it's your porn stash or, you know, all the things that Marines could collect in some way, shape, or form. So there's a couple different schools of thought of how you do that, and then some people are obviously what that happened with you, Jeff. It's like, no, that's all the shit. Put it in there. And
that was the shit that he cut off me that day.
But normally that's supposed to go.
Though, like you're talking about back in my little swa hut cube I had.
Right.
John Bylus and John Dunn and those other guys, Mac, the guys on my team, they put it together. And me and Lori picked up at the on Camp Del Mar at the supply building right across from you know, where the G7 building is.
That'd be meth supply, right?
That's if you're alive.
If you're dead, you're right.
It's way more pain in the ass.
Yeah. So I mean, and that is the underside of, you know, like combat operations, right? And then so what happens when? And kind of personal story. I saw pictures of in Ramadi in 2004. When 2-4 had, I want to say it was 16 Marines killed that day.
That was Echo Company, right?
I think so. And then their air officer I met, because I used to go, like Paul took me out a couple times to go AI stuff. And I'd go over there with General Kelly, because when he was going to see 2-4, he'd tell me. And so I'd, you know, go hang out with Paul Kennedy for a while, a buddy. And so I got to know those guys, and their officer, he had all these images, and he said, hey, sir, I'll share them with you. And a bunch of them are like 16 boxes of, you know, the boxes that we use to do this stuff are what? There'd be like 2x2x6 by, I don't know, maybe 3 feet tall or something like that.
Right.
You know, it's something like that. It's 24x24x48 inches tall. And, you know, with Marines standing there, inventory, you know, all this gear from all these Marines that have been killed. And you're just sitting there looking at, like, that's the rest of the story. People got to go back, and they've got to deal with that stuff. And so
even you doing that can be hairy. I mean,
oh, shit.
I think Randy Newman relieved Paul in there.
Yeah.
And I think they had Purple Hearts on the PDSS.
Oh, shit, they did. I'll tell you what, yeah. I have a video of a ID going off on 2.5's PDSS, and right. Literally it's this fireball that they drive through. You can see off to the right, you can see a container, and it was fuel, and they set off this ID, and the whole light in the video goes away. And all you can see is fire. It looks like Dante's Inferno. And somebody got shrapnel to the hand. Because everybody didn't have an up-armored Humvee then. We still had some of that Frankenstein shit.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you bolted on and fucking got a little L-shaped right. opening.
Yo, shit. And you look back on it now and you're like, that's... But we didn't... I mean, nobody ever heard of IEDs, right? The South Africans had, but we hadn't. And then, you know, they started blowing up, and then we started... You know, these modifications, Kevlar, like these Kevlar blankets on the doors and sandbagging the floor. And those were, you know, expeditionary, you know, kind of a ghetto retrofit shit. And then the first time I ever saw a fucking up-armored Humvee, it was in pictures that somebody sent from Huseiba. And they said, check this out. And the windshield had been stitched by... You know, probably some kind of, you know, AK, right? And they're like, and you're like, well, what happened to the dudes inside? And they're like, nothing. That's bulletproof glass. And like, what are you fucking talking about? This is an up-armored Humvee. And then I remember talking to somebody, well, I thought the up-armored Humvees had those quarter-inch, you know, those angled doors. No, that's like ghetto-ass retrofitting.
I have to
tell you, listen to this. Where did this come from? Well, the third ACR left it, and they got him. Well, where does it come from? Where does it exist in the DOD? Oh, the Air Force invented it. What? Yeah, the fucking Air Force invented this armored car for themselves, and that was the first. And I mean, the doors are thicker than shit. I remember. Right, and I was like, ah, and guys would survive fucking huge blasts in that thing.
One thing about that though, Mac, those, you know, jury rigged ones we had in like 2004, 2005.
Right.
You didn't have the casualties from the overpressure that you had with the new the newer ones, because there's just nothing getting. So when that shit would go off, you being inside that thing was like it was just weird, man. It would cause more internal injury type stuff than if you had an open window. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was weird, but it was way better for sure. I mean, it was impenetrable for most stuff.
Right. Okay, I think we're done. Any final thoughts? Where's John Wayne, the quiet man?
Hey, man, John Wayne was sitting here thinking, I preferred riding around in a Corolla. You guys are fucking crazy driving around in those big old M-Drafts.
And who would waste that's a all good I got to say about that. Corolla, man. You're right.
No,
I know I'm right. They got 7 years of proving I was right.
They don't... It wasn't a Corolla. It was an Opel.
Well, actually...
No, I had Opels, Corollas. I had pickups. I had a shit ton of cars.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, they rotated them out regularly. That's like nobody used it. These guys just drive around in Chevy loves, and they never got ID'd. Cause why would you waste a perfectly good ID on something you could knock out with a 9mm?
Exactly.
In Afghanistan, they. Okay, here's the final question, a political question. Mike Pompeo on Monday said that President Trump told him to get us out of Afghanistan before the 2020 election.
To cut number of troops by 2020.
Right.
I don't think he said totally get out, but...
This is significantly cut the number of troops.
Yeah.
It's a far cry from the condition-based event that, you know, his administration came in on. And, you know what it just smacks to me when I hear it? I hear Vietnamization. You know? I hear Vietnamization.
Oh, yeah, we're even past that.
Right.
I said before, whether it was now or it's 4 years or 6 years from now, this is how it's going to end. It doesn't matter. It's just a question of how much longer we're going to string it out. I've been saying that consistently, I think, for a year now.
As you said, Tim, when really gonna shit's gonna hit the fan is when we stop paying the fucking ANSAF. Just like the Russians, when they stopped paying the Afghan army that was Russian made, that's when everything collapsed. Not right when they left.
And FY 2020 is when it's scheduled to be renewed. And somebody, Congress has got to authorize that. I guess they don't have to because of that continuing resolution that we passed in 2001, which is bullshit.
Not a continuing resolution, but the AUMF, right?
AUMF, I'm sorry. Thank you, Ben. Yeah, because
hey, boom, how about that? Hey, how about that for some dork shit? Mac, you just crossed the Rubicon, bro. You are now officially a fucking dork.
You're in a floppy disk.
In 2020, they got to have money. It's just that simple.
Right. I saw that headline and I thought, I just had a captain call me this week, who was telling me that he gave my post-traumatic winning class to his company. And he told a story about his mother, who's Vietnamese, and what happened to them, after the North Vietnamese came into South Vietnam. And the number of people in her family that were murdered in front of her and stuff like that. And so, he told me how great, he told me how much he enjoyed doing it. And he said, hey, sir, just so you know, those three goals and nine commandments are up in every room that I have Marines in our barracks. And I said, that's awesome. I said, let me just tell you, you're going to save somebody's life, right? It might be a Marines. It might be one of their family members. It might be one of those friends. But I guarantee you this. You know, that stuff resonates, and Marines, it makes sense to them, and they go help people. I said, so good on you. So, but it was real interesting, and it got me thinking about the whole Vietnamization and then Pompeo's remarks. Is that what we're going to see happen in Afghanistan? I think you guys have both been on the mark in terms of, you're going to see, they're not going to share the money. The city-states will be what they are. The Taliban will control the rural areas. And then there's going to be either some kind of deal cut, which is the way they do it, or you will see more fighting where the Taliban attempts to go into the city and run everybody out. So
hey, but look at the bright side. So here in Texas, there was a significant migration of Vietnamese after the 70s, after the fall of Vietnam, and they settled along the coast, got involved mostly in low-level fishing and whatnot. Within a generation, they're gone. I mean, their children now are doctors and professors. I mean, they came in here within a generation, were bolted way up into the middle class. Maybe we'll be able to say that about our Afghan friends, some dons. We'll years from now, we'll be able to say, hey, yeah, but when the Afghans settled over here, they started out kind of low on the totem pole, but look at how well they're doing now.
I get my hair cut in San Clemente the barbershop is on on the east side of El Camino Real, right where Del Mar tees into El Camino Real. And the guy who cuts my hair is a former lieutenant colonel in the South Vietnamese Army. His name's Randy. And he lives up here by me in Westminster, and he drives down to San Clemente every day to cut hair. But Randy was telling me one day the story of what happened after he was captured. Like, holy shit, man. Every night, right? You put your neck into this bamboo holder and they slide a bar in front of it that's like has like 50 people, and then they put your feet in this other bamboo, rack, and they lock it, and you sit. That's how you live. That's how you sleep. And then you go out and work, and in your quote unquote re-education program. And then he said he was, he's really lucky to survive that and then be able to come here. And he's just the nicest dude in the world. And he loves the United States, and he loves what he's been able to do for his kids and his grandkids. And so, but a really interesting, I mean, fuck, man, you talk about rough roads,
But a good story about how America does in fact welcome in all kinds of migrants who are not in the best shape when they arrive here. And like I said, within a generation, they're gone.
Now, let me tell you, there's a lot of Vietnamese. I have a Vietnamese family that lives right across the street from me. And those fucking kids, they come home from school, man, and they go in and they study. And then at at like 5 o'clock, they all come out and they play in the front yard. They play basketball, they play soccer, they play volleyball, they play whatever, right? And the mom's a school teacher. She's walking around the neighborhood, like doing laps and stuff. And then they all go. They spend the day at Vietnamese church on Sunday. And they're great kids. On Veterans Day, they come over and they knock on the door, and they say, "Mr. Mike, we just want to say Happy Veterans Day to you." And they invite me to the programs at their Catholic school, and it's pretty cool to see the structure of Asian families and how they produce winners. And and the Vietnamese culture is, man, it's a hardworking, you know, proud culture, especially, you know, those that have come here. So pretty cool.
Well, and they've done so well. They're now de facto white people
like that, and actually the Nigerians, they really, you know, they stand up too.
Oh yeah, Nigerians are gonna run the risk of becoming white people too, because already the Vietnamese and Chinese, they're, as far as like Harvard and Yale are concerned, they're white folk. Boom. There's too many of them. They're overrepresented.
It's just,
again, it's just so frustrating that when you know, we go places with all the best intentions, but it's like we can't line up our grand strategy with the reality on the ground. It's like we don't have a clear picture going in, and then ultimately, at some point, we're forced to reconcile ourselves with that. And in the case of Afghanistan, it is, you know, we didn't learn from the Soviet, you know, in spite of the Soviet, you know, philosophy of life, in spite of that, you know, we didn't learn from it. We're Americans. It'll be different because we're doing it. And you know, at the end of the day, the truth is, it wasn't different because we were doing it. We ran into the same issues, and
there's a book called The Great Gamble about them by a guy named Pfeiffer. It's outstanding, and you see a lot of what you just said. On the other hand, we got a hard time.
Wait a second. I was just going to mention that because I found that goddamn book and I was starting to read it. I'm like, this is excellent, but then somebody took it from me, and I never saw it again. Who would that be, Mr. Jeff?
I took your book. I got like 3 or 4 copies of that.
No, that's why you were rolling. That was written about specifically talked about the Soviets withdrawing out of Jalalabad and how the Afghans had stripped the barracks of even the window frames in under 45 minutes, something along that line.
Well, let me tell you, that's bullshit, because the Filipinos, when we left Subic, it didn't take them 12 minutes to rip out everything, to include the copper wire.
Yeah, but the Philippines are much more industrial.
Leatherneck still, you could use those cans if you had to. It's kind of weird.
No, I'm serious, Jeff. There was a book. It may not be the same book, but it was.
How do you think he got 3 copies if he wasn't rolling around the planet taking everybody's book?
I think so.
Well, I had one on my Kindle, but I did. I like to take books from people so that they're fucked.
I didn't need as much as you.
It's, hey, enlightenment is a competitive event. If he's getting smarter, that means I'm getting stupider.
Praise books. I steal those fucking those books you get when you buy a new Toyota. I steal those like nobody's business.
Nobody.
Hey, Jeff must have spent with 5 or 6 moving boxes full of coffee, so he could have all the books he wanted.
But, you know, my friends steal from me, too. I have my buddy, Mike Maimon. He's all these books open up, and it says in the front thing, stolen from the library of Jeff Kenny. And he puts the date in there, you know?
He has the embosser?
Yes. He just scrawled it in there. You know?
Okay, here's a question. Do you have an embosser, Kenny?
No.
Tim, do you have an embosser?
I don't know what one is.
I do not.
I think I can figure it out. But.
Well, you know, people have them. They're those metal presses that you take the page and it says, from the library of of Jeff Kenney. Jeff Reginald Kenney.
Yeah, right. Yes, I got all the, it's like, I got my penthouse letters library, you know, and
Woo! Tell me there was nothing, let me tell you, we shouldn't even have this conversation. All right, on that note, I was going to give away the farm right there, but, yeah, we'll let that one go. Thanks, boys. Have a great day.
All right, brother. Take care, man.
All right, there you have it. I almost said some shit I shouldn't have said. Anyway, more Bombing Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. That's called maturity, showing restraint in certain situations. Oh, my God. All right, we'll leave it at that. Bob Nielsen sent me a link to a CNN article written by Barbara Starr, their CNN Pentagon correspondent, entitled "Exclusive Top U.S. Navy SEAL Tells Commanders in a Letter, We Have a Problem." That to be filed under a firm grasp of the obvious. Well, no shit, you've had a problem for a while. Now, look, at least we admitted it. The story goes like this. Top U.S. Navy SEAL recently sent a blistering letter to the force, writing in bold-faced type, "We have a problem," following several high-profile incidents of alleged misbehavior by members of the U.S. Navy's elite service. Rear Admiral Colin Green has given commanders until August 7 to detail the problems they see and provide recommendations on how they will ensure troops are engaging in ethical and professional behavior. The letter, dated July 25th and exclusively obtained by CNN, comes in the wake of several high-profile incidents of alleged misbehavior by SEALs. Quote, "I don't know yet if we have a cultural problem." They do. "I do know that we have a good order and discipline problem that must be addressed immediately." You know, when it's as widespread as it is, you have a cultural problem. So I offer that to you there, sir. Although Green does not mention specific incidents, the letter comes on the heels of an entire SEAL team being sent home from Iraq following allegations of a sexual assault and drinking alcohol during their downtime, which is against regulations. Again, which they've always done, which is a cultural problem. Another case involved an internal Navy investigation that found members of SEAL Team 10 allegedly abused cocaine and other illegal drugs while they were stationed in Virginia last year. Green said in the letter, quote, "Some of our subordinate formations have failed to maintain good order and discipline, and as a result, and for good reason, the culture of the Navy Special Operations Force is being questioned." I mean, look, how many times has it had to happen before this, you know, this level? Now, here's what's interesting, and here's what's on the money. I'll tell you, when you're more concerned about everybody's feelings and about whether everybody got hazed than you are with mission accomplishment and good order and discipline, right? And that's what the military's been focused on. Kind of Burger King, have it your way. Then this is bleeding into all of this. Discipline, nobody wants to be that guy. And we've talked about it. Marine staff NCOs. I'm going to crawl up that guy's ass and then get accused of hazing and have my career compromised. Yeah. And I'm going to listen to it right after this, but in Vice Admiral Mike Gilday, who's going to be the CNO, he had his hearing yesterday. And he was asked specifically about the SEALs and their misconduct. And he said, quote, that he said he's committed to getting a better understanding of those issues, to hold people accountable if they need to be held accountable, to getting to the root causes and ensure that if there is a problem with the culture, with the community, that that is addressed very, very quickly and firmly. So then, in the last four or five paragraphs, it starts to look at systemic problems. Is the problem systemic? Second to the last paragraph. There are also growing concerns in the Marine Corps of troops adhering to ethics and cultural standards. Recently, 18, now that number's 24, Marines and one sailor were arrested at Camp Pendleton over allegations of human smuggling. General Berger also said that over the last 10 years, more than 25,000 Marines have been dismissed from the service for misconduct, for drugs and alcohol offenses. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. All right, that'll do it on a Thursday. Don't touch that dial. We'll check. We'll talk about Secretary Spencer and saying that I commit to you to speak truth to power, and then having to do it. As the President of the United States gets out his 10,000-foot screwdriver and says, don't award those Navy achievement medals to those prosecutors. The question is, did they deserve them or not? And if they did deserve them, then somebody ought to stand up and say, Mr. President, I'll use the example of the USS Fitzgerald and the McCain. In the midst of those disasters, there were people that performed admirably and did their duty and ought to have been awarded those medals or whatever they were awarded. The same thing could apply here. I don't know that's true. They could have conducted themselves throughout all the ups and downs of the Gallagher case in an exemplary manner and therefore earned some kind of award. I don't know that to be a fact, but that's what Secretary Spencer ought to look into. And then, if he says, hey, Mr. President, here's what I think. I think this guy deserved it, these two didn't. Here's what I would like to do. And if the president says no, then you have your salute point. And as I said before, is it worth a resignation? No. But that's the President of the United States reaching pretty far into the United States military, denying a Navy achievement medal. But he is a commander-in-chief. So you'll hear about that. Check the news of the day, and then you'll hear the recently concluded Lynch and Kenny event. So yeah, all that in one exciting cavalcade of audio programming right here on your favorite place for all good things, entertaining and informative. Yeah, don't be afraid to add informative in there. The All Warrior Radio Network, led by All Marine Radio. So, on a Thursday, the day before Friday, have a great day. All Marine Radio, over and out.